Tonight to we're in a study on the Song of Solomon. So find the Song of Solomon, chapter 1. But before we get to that, we're going to look somewhat at the lifestyle of Solomon in 1 Kings and chapter 10. 1 Kings and chapter 10. Began a new series that we call Divine Principles or Categories relative to human love and human relationships in the love relationship. And we're using the Song of Solomon as a background for that. And we discovered that the Song of Solomon is the story of a victorious human love relationship between a beautiful shepherdess, and not shepherdess, a beautiful gal who was actually a vineyard dresser, a vineyard dresser, from northern Palestine, a young woman who was engaged, betrothed, to a shepherd in northern Palestine. And in the course of her personal existence near the town of Shulam, and her relationship with her brothers who had sort of isolated her to the vineyards, she had come across an entourage of Solomon. And either by enveiglement or by perhaps out of a personal necessity, in terms of personal needs, she was enveigled into Solomon's entourage. And the Song of Solomon opens in one of the apartments of Solomon, perhaps near his vineyards, which were near Baal Hamon, north of Jerusalem. Solomon, by this time, had established a lifestyle of opulence, of lascivious self-indulgence. This happened very early after he arrived at the throne. And in the 10th chapter of 1 Kings, we're given somewhat of an idea of what this lifestyle was like. I'm going to start reading at verse 14 of 1 Kings 10. And this gives you somewhat of the idea, the background of what that apartment that Solomon maintained was like. Now the weight of the gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Now let's do some figuring, okay? This was Solomon's personal income. Regardless of how it came, whether it came by taxes, whether it came by imposition on other nations or what, this was his personal income. 666 talents of gold. Now this word talent is a word that means circle in Hebrew. It's the word karkar or kikar. Kikar. Technically it means a circle. But it comes to mean in turn the largest of the Hebrew weights and measures. Okay? I don't know what the largest of our measure is. Do you? Well, my meat bullion, they're supposed to mean it 200 ounce. Is that right? 200 ounce? 400 ounce bars? It was interesting when the United States, there's a standardized bar of gold. And I don't mean nationally standard, I mean internationally standardized. So that if you were to sell a gold bar, you would sell a certain weight, a certain number of troy ounces. 400, I heard somewhere 200, but this is the market in gold, the international market. It's interesting that when the United States Mint began to sell off their gold, and the reason they're selling that off is to subdue the gold market, to keep the price of gold down, because there's a terrible fear, rightfully so, within the Treasury Department of the United States relative to gold. So when they went to sell the gold, they sold it in 100-ounce bars. Now that meant the people that bought the gold, if they want to sell it on the international market, has to remelt it, you see, and cast it into the international standardized bar. I don't understand all the implications of our government in that, but I'll tell you, they're all bad. Well, this was the largest of the weights and measures in the Hebrew scale. It's thought that the talent was the normal weight that a man could carry, at least a little ways. It weighed almost what a bundle of roof shingles weighed. See, one talent weighed like a bundle of roof shingles. When was the last time you roofed your house? You had to carry those bundles up the ladder. See, I just got my roof destroyed about 2 weeks ago by hail, so I got this on my mind. A talent was 93 pound, 12 ounces. This is how it's defined in the dictionary, and I don't know if I know how to figure this exactly. There's 93 pounds, 12 ounces, in the avoir du poids cell. Did you ever hear this term? Avoir du poids. Now it said that it was 125 troy weight. This is pounds and ounces. 125 troy weight. Kenny, would this be pounds? Huh? Pounds, okay. That's what one talent weighed. Okay? Now, in the dictionaries that I looked at, which are based upon the old Smith dictionary, which was done around the turn of the century, they said that a talent was worth $30,000. So all of this would be broken down at that time to about $30,000. Okay? So 666 times 30,000 would be 19,980,000. Now, that's at the old system of measuring when the dollar was based on a gold standard. But the dollar in the United States is no longer on a gold standard. In fact, what's a dollar worth? There's only way to figure it is by its purchasing power. It doesn't have any much purchasing power anymore. In other words, this 19,980,000 translated into dollars today would probably be 10 times that much. And you'd have to figure it on the basis of this troy weight, see? What's an ounce of troy weight of gold worth today, Don? What market value, huh? That's 1 ounce, right? Is there 16 ounces in a troy weight pound? 12. 12 ounces. So this would be, 125 would be 10 of those. Well, I'm not going to figure that. I'm not going to take the time. Stand here figuring out, I'll be wasting my time. Look, this figure would probably be at least tripled. Or it'd be five times as much. Five times as much. Be almost $1 billion his income a year. I think I could get along on that. Yeah. I think I could support my wife in the manner that she'd like to be accustomed to on that. And this came to him in 1 year. It's interesting that it came in gold, too, by the way. Not in paper money. Okay. Now, in the next few verses, it begins to tell what he did with the money. It talks a little bit about his trading. There's more money coming in, I'm sorry. 16 starts where he did it. Beside that, he added the merchantmen and the traffic of the spice merchants and all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the country. In other words, he just had all kind of income coming in terms of material goods. Number 16, King Solomon made 200 targets, that word means bucklers, of beaten gold. And 600 shekels of gold, which would be approximately $6,000, went into one buckler, one of these shield defenses that a military man would carry. So he begins to get pretty fancy with his defense budget. In the 17th verse, he made 300 shields of beaten gold. 3 pounds of gold went into one shield. That's $1,800 a shield. That sounds like the Arabians bidding on a fighter plane or something like that. You'd imagine having a shield that cost $1,800 in those days, made out of gold. And the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Now that house of the forest of Lebanon, I'm not sure if that's a reference to his palace in Jerusalem or an apartment that he maintained. See? We know that the palace that he made was made out of the cedars of Lebanon, and it may be a reference to that palace that's referred to in the 7th chapter. Foundation stones in that building were 12 to 16 cubic feet, one stone, just in the foundation. That's as big as the rooms in my house. I figured it out, his house in Palestine. The figure escapes me. It was something like, does anybody remember what it was? 12,000 square feet of living space? Almost as big as Hal Malloy's house. Now, Solomon, this chapter is going to speak about his wisdom. But Solomon is out of it. He is establishing a lifestyle that he can't support. And he's not going to be able to maintain it. So he's going to run his nation into such debt that he's going to, due to his personal aggrandizement, that he's going to have slave labor to take care of all these buildings that he's making, and he's going to have to impose taxes on the people too much for them to bear. And by the time he dies, they're ready for a revolution. They have a civil war when he dies because of this. Let's go on and see his lifestyle that he's establishing. Okay? Verse 18. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. And the throne had 6 steps, and the top of the throne was round behind. And there were stairs on either side on the place of the seat. And 2 lions stood beside the stays. And 12 lions stood there on the one side, and on the other upon the 6 steps. In other words, there was a lion. Here's his throne. Here's his throne sitting here. He had a stay here and a stay here. And there's a lion laying here. And he had these big, broad steps going down, 6 on each side. So this throne was elevated, with a lion on laying on each one of those steps. Now imagine coming in to see him. Sound like a zoo. This is his lifestyle. He's living typically like an Oriental monarch. Verse 21. And all King Solomon's drinking vessels, I forgot to read the last part of verse 20. There was not the like made in any kingdom. There was not a throne room in any kingdom like Solomon's throne room for opulence. Verse 21, and all of King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. There's a reference again to that house, whether that's his palace or whether that is the one of these apartments, we don't know. Were of pure gold. None were of silver. It was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon. And if you translate that literally, it would say it was as nothing. Everything gold, everything silver, a throne out of ivory covered with pure gold, with 12 lions lying around beside it. It was SOP for Solomon. That's the kind of apartment he built north of Palestine, where he had part of his harem. And he entertains Haremsville with sheer luxury. Okay? Verse 22. For the king had at sea a navy of Tarshish with the navy of Harem. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish, bringing gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. So Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. And I have sought the Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. And they brought every man his present, vessels of silver, vessels of gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, mules, a rate year by year. It was levied on them. Verse 26, and Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. And he had 1,400 chariots. How do you like that for, think of the garage he had to have. 12,000 horsemen. He didn't have a garage. What he did, he built cities to house this cavalry. He built cities. He bestowed in the cities of for chariots and with the king of Jerusalem. The chariot cities were Megiddo, Gezer, and Hazor. He had it spread out over Palestine. Up in Megiddo, which is in the valley of Megiddo, runs down from Mount Carmel, like, here's Mount Carmel, this natural geographic landmark of Palestine on the Med Sea, and running down through there is the valley of Esdraelon, and there's a fortified city right near the end of that called Megiddo. Armageddon gets its name from Megiddo. But at Megiddo, which was one of these stable fortress cities, they've uncovered stables of Solomon. He had stables at Megiddo that could house 450 horses and 150 chariots in one town. Now, this was part of the PWA, the Public Works Administration of Solomon. He had to have people maintain the horses, you know. Did you ever try to maintain a horse? There's a few little side jobs to that that teach you humility. It's like the two churches that were having a Sunday school contest. And that you had a little gimmick job to get people to Sunday school, and so that they decide what would be a good prize for this, and the guy says, well, let's have the winning side gets to ride an elephant around the losing church. So the winning pastor gets to ride the elephant around the losing church, and we'll call it Elephant Sunday. And it worked out very well because, the elephant was going around the church, he was fertilizing the lawn. So the losing pastor not only learned a little bit of humility by losing the contest, but he had to clean up after the elephant. So it had a lot of fringe benefits. Sunday school contest. Friend of mine thought the better one. They had one that was going to be flood the bus Sunday. You think that sounds funny, doesn't it? You know what flood the bus Sunday was to get people to Sunday school? Everybody that rode the bus, when they got on the bus, they were handed a water pistol. This is for real. There's a company that sells the water pistols. And they advertise, use this to get people to Sunday school. So the idea was that if the bus driver didn't hustle enough during the week and didn't get his bus filled, then everybody when they went out, they could squirt the water at the bus driver. And that was a big spiritual treat. Well, my friend from Greeley He's from Arkansas. He has the greatest wit I've ever seen. He's just great. Called me up and said, "Hey, now you hear about the new Sunday school?" This guy's a pastor. "So you hear about the new Sunday school contest for the bus Sunday?" Told me about it. He says, "I'm going to bail on Flood the Bus Sunday." So I said, "I'm going to have Flood the Bus Sunday." And he says, "I'm going to give everybody that's on the bus a whole watermelon. Then they're going to ride for 100 miles without stopping. And they have to eat the watermelon on the way." "They're going to call it Flood the Bus Sunday." I said, "You're hired for the next Sunday school contest." This paragraph that we're reading about Solomon's opulence and about his self-indulgence precedes the paragraph that talks about his spiritual downfall. If you look at the 11th chapter, I'll skip these next verses because we're getting a little bit behind here. Solomon actually lived in total self-indulgence. He would have to resort to forced labor and heavy taxation to maintain this luxurious, voluptuous lifestyle. In the 11th chapter, it says Solomon loved many strange women together with the daughter of Pharaoh. You notice the word "but" there? "But"? See, that connects out with that previous chapter. Verse 3 says he had 700 wives, princes, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. In other words, the real Solomon, his test was success, and he failed the test. One of the hardest tests in life is what human beings call success. Now, what is success to the average human being? Success to the average human being is having a lifestyle like Solomon. He's got apartments all over the country. They're outfitted in the epitome of luxury and opulence, and he's got women in all the apartments. And you talk to the average person in the United States, and that is it. He's arrived. And from divine viewpoint, he failed under that. God gave him all that money and the wisdom to accrue that money, and he failed under that system. Now, the Song of Solomon is the story of Solomon inveigling a beautiful young woman who is engaged and in love, deeply in love with a shepherd, into one of those apartments where he has part of his harem. And the book is the story of his efforts to seduce her, and she resists him with her book. Now when you turn to the first chapter in the fifth verse where we ended our discussion last time. I'm repeating for all of our sake, but particularly for people who haven't been here. The Song of Solomon is written in Hebrew poetic style. Hence, the interpretation of the book is very subjective. The interpretation that we're following adheres largely to the Amplified Bible. And I would imagine that the New American Standard probably adheres to that, since the same foundation sponsored the Amplified Bible, as did sponsor the New American Standard. I don't know, I have not looked at the New American Standard. Okay? So that if you're reading the King James Version, I'm going to be reading the Amplified, and I hope you'll try to follow along, because the Amplified inserts interpretive notes so that you can follow the theme of the poem. Okay? The place setting is in the apartments of Solomon, not in Jerusalem, but north of the city, And in these apartments, Solomon is maintaining Hiramsville in a classic Arabian style. Everyone is dressed and groomed sumptuously. The queens and concubines are amazed when a sunburned country girl is ushered into her presence in the very clothes that she was wearing in her vineyard. And she says in verse 6, I am black, but comely. Oh, I'm not reading Amplified. I'm sorry. I am so black. I am comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, exclaimed the stranger. I am as dark and ugly as the tents of the Bedouin tribe Kedar. Amplified interprets here that the harem girls interrupt and say, no, you're beautiful like the curtains of Solomon. I don't think that's necessary. I think she's saying she's like the tents of Solomon also. In other words, this girl had been overexposed to the sun. In the sixth verse, she tells a little bit about how this happened. Please do not look at me, she said, for I am swarthy, I am black. I have worked out in the sun, and it has left its mark upon me. My stepbrothers were angry with me, and they made me a keeper of the vineyards. But my own vineyard, meaning my own complexion, I have not kept. Okay? Now, I think that's where we left off last time. We did say something about verse 7. Now, in verse 7, this Shulamite woman begins to speak out of her soul relative to her shepherd lover. And she expresses herself this way. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves. That is a very knowledgeable statement about human love. She has identified with a man in her soul. She has been responsive to him in her soul. To the degree that she now identifies with him in love relationship. Nothing said about her physical relationship with a man. In fact, she has not had a physical relationship with him. O you whom my soul loves, tell me where you pasture your flock. Will you make it to lie down at noon? For why should I think of you? Well, I don't like the Amplified there. The latter part of verse 6 reads pretty good. The latter part of verse 7 reads pretty good in the King James. Why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companion? Or if you have a margin, as the Scofield does, why should I be as one that is veiled so that you cannot see me? And I cannot see you like I would like. Now, I don't think I understood this till one day I was hiking in the Mono Compadres, around the northwest side of Mono Compadre. And I broke out at the timber line there. My son and I were together, and there was countless sheep up above the timber line. They were heading up over a pass on Mono Compadre. And the sheep herder had just broken down his camp. He had a horse and a mule and two dogs, and he had 2,500 sheep. So he was just about ready to get on the horse, and we walked up there, and I spoke to him, and here he was, a Basque, right out of northern Spain. What's it? The Pyrenees. Right out, isn't that the Pyrenees Mountains that separate Spain and France? Right on the southern side of the Pyrenees. So I said to him, he could speak a little broken English. Big man. Tall. Blue eyes. Spaniard. Basque. I said, how long have you been in the United States? 3 months. How did you come here? I come to shepherd. Where have you been? How do you like the United States? I don't know. He said, you don't know? He says, no, these are all I see for 3 months. I says, man, you see the most beautiful part of the United States. And what he was telling me was that after 3 months, he'd been running the sheep around up above timber or in the pastures up there in the north of the San Juan Mountains. And he had them down. They brought the food to him. And they met him at various places, see? Well, this is what the Shulamite woman is thinking about. She is thinking about a shepherd that she loves, and she's wondering where he is with his flock. And she's wishing that she could be there. Now, you get the picture? She's in one of these tapestry-lined apartments of Solomon with, in the midst of luxury, where people are dressed, you know, out of sight. You know, it's Saks Fifth Avenue. It's Miami Beach. What's the main street? Collins Avenue, Miami. You know, it's Paris. These people are dressed fit to kill. They're dining on the best foods available in the whole world. And this girl is saying, boy, I sure wish I was out there in the fields with my shepherd lover. Well, why did she say that? She said that because her soul has so strongly responded to a man that the opulence of Solomon didn't even phase her mentality. He didn't even impress her. In fact, she wanted to be out of it. Okay, so she utters this wildly in the midst of Hamsville. Hamsville is made up of concubines, married women to Solomon. There are 60, well, exactly how many are at this apartment? But probably around 60, maybe 80. That's 60 wives and 80 concubines. And then there were called, in Hamsville, there were three groups. There were the daughters of Jerusalem, there were the queens, and there were the concubines. The daughters of Jerusalem were virgins, or at least young women who Solomon was grooming for his harem. See? So she speaks up in verses 6 and 7, and then in verse 8, one of the gals in Hamsville speaks back to her. Verse 8, if you do not know where your lover is, O thou fairest among women, run along, follow the tracks of the flock, and amuse yourself by pasturing your kids besides the shepherd's tents. Now, that's a little bit of Sadie Hawkins type advice. She says, why don't you just try to run him down and seek him out? Well, she's not going to do that because she knows she doesn't have to do that. She knows that man is responsive to her in a proper male-female relationship, and he's going to be looking for her. But in the meantime, she's going to be heartsick while she's away from him. Now, Amplified, I think correctly so, interprets verse 9 and 10 as Solomon speaking. And with the background that we had, why, I think it will make sense. Before long, Amplified inserts this in the text, Solomon comes in to inspect his new acquisition, which is the Shunammite woman. And he says, O my loves, he said as he saw her. Now, King James here says, you remind me of a company of horses. Now, it's a very poor translation. He really says, you remind me of my favorite mare. A man who has destroyed his soul by multi-sexual experiences does not know how to talk intelligently to a woman. If a woman has any sense at all, shall read him as a fool immediately. But even if Solomon opens his mouth in his book, he's a fool. He looked like my favorite mare down in the Fabio group of my horses and Fabio chariots. My favorite mare and Fabio chariot spans. Your cheeks are comely with ornaments. Your neck with strings of jewels. We're going to make you more. We're going to make you chains and ornaments of gold. Started with silver. See, she's just there in her super outfit. And he's saying, we're going to really buy you up, babe. Well, I've got the jewelry coming for you. You know, you're stunning now, but you'll be a real knockout before we get through with you. Well, the Amplified inserts in the text here, the vineyard girl, however, had not forgotten the task which she had set for herself. And as soon as Solomon, who was seated, gave her an opportunity to speak, she made use of it. And she says, while a king sits at his table, she said, my spikenard, my absent lover, sends forth his fragrance over me. King James translates verse 13, a bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night betwixt my breasts. She's not talking about her beloved in that the bundle of myrrh is what she's talking about. It shall lie between my breasts, not the man. So the Amplified will translate the verse 14 this way. Verse 13. My beloved, meaning her shepherd, is to me like a scent bag, see? Like a spikenard, which was the heroine of the day. And all the guys in that day wanted to smell nice too. And we really appreciate that, ladies. I mean, we know that some people like to live a separated life, but let's not carry separation too far, you know? Don't stay too far separated from the deodorant and nice perfume. It's great. And this was their form of perfume. She's not talking about the shepherd lover lying between her breasts. She's talking about this bundle of myrrh, this spikenard, which was sort of a perfume scent bag that women wore in that day. So she says, well, associated with the shepherd lover is a sense of smell. This is part of her soul. And so she says in verse 13, my beloved shepherd is to me like a scent bag of myrrh that lies between my breasts and my bosom. So it must have meant that he at least practiced good body hygiene. Well, he smelled nice around her. Maybe she likes his aftershave lotion. I don't know. Every person in the proper human love relationship develops certain attractive factors and features that when the two are apart, then memory center is going to open up and recall that. See? And memory center is opened up in her mind and she remembers his aftershave lotion. She's away from him. She's geographically separated from him. And she says, I wish he were here. I wish I could see him. I wish I could be with him. This is what's happening to her. Because in her soul, she has identified so strong with him. Okay, verse 14, she continues, my beloved, meaning her shepherd, is to me like a cluster of hay flowers. The King James translates this campfire. It's camphor. Well, I don't know camphor. I don't think she'd be saying that he was like the camphor that I know. Camphor is like a rub, isn't it? Camphor rub, right? Good for sore muscles. They put a little camphor in various things. This is a cypress flower that grew near the vineyards of Engedi. Engedi was down by the west side of the Dead Sea. Here's Jerusalem. The Shalom was up here from Shulam, and Engedi was down here. It's nothing for these people to travel miles with those sheep, you see, to shepherd them. But anyhow, this flower was well known throughout Palestine, and the town of Engedi was famed for these fragrant shrubs. And she says, my beloved is to me like a cluster of henna flowers, cypress flowers, from the vineyards of Engedi. Okay? Now she's interrupted. in verse 15. Old Solomon is making advances now. And she has ignored him. She has thought about, when he speaks to her as a beloved one, she thinks about her beloved one. And she has ignored him entirely. So in verse 16, the Amplified explains verse 16 this way. But the determined girl is quite as capable of ignoring speeches as was Solomon. In other words, he doesn't listen to what she says in the book, and she doesn't listen to what he says. There is actually a nice parallel pair between this girl and Solomon, and between Queen Solomon and this girl, see? Okay, and as if she had not been interrupted, she sees the... Pardon me, I skipped verse. The king ignored the girl's speech and continued, and he said, "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. You are a little pigeon." That is almost what he said, because the word for dove there means a rock pigeon. And this rock pigeon in Palestine was known for an appearance of tenderness that was connotated by its eyes. I think that's interesting. Now Solomon, throughout the book, whenever Solomon speaks and he's trying to hustle this gal, he emphasizes her physical attractiveness. Every time he speaks, you watch. He's going to start with her hair and he's going to work slowly down. He's going to describe her whole body. It's going to be all physical. That's his attraction to her. And she knows that. And she knows she's physically attractive. Everybody knows that a curved line is not a straight line. And God made a woman with curved lines so that men who have enough sense would appreciate that. Well, of course, the women are nicer to look at than men. Solomon will always overemphasize the physical part of this woman. She will always emphasize her soul relationship with the man that she loves. She's strong and stable. Solomon's soul is destroyed by multi-sexual relations. Okay, so she ignores him. And this is what the Amplified says. But the girl is quite as capable of ignoring speeches as was Solomon. And if she had not been interrupted, she seized upon his own words, and addressing them to her absent lover, she cried, "Behold, you are beautiful, my beloved shepherd. You are delightful. The one that you are preparing for us appeals to me more than any other." This is what's going through. "Our arbor and our couch are green and leafy." Okay? Now, if you're right, she's talking about a bed. The bed that he's making for her. And this will be their marital bed. Okay? When she says, "Our bed is green," this is a Hebrew idiom for an unused bed. Unused, but prepared. And the rustic simplicity of it is in... it's prepared in rustic simplicity. And you might remember that she's sitting in Solomon's palace with Persian rugs on the floor and pillows all over the place. Best you can have. Softest pillows in the world, made out of belly button grump. Sure. Belly button grump is the softest substance known to man. Soft, brown pillows all over the room. And she's standing with her shepherd lover and she says, "Our bed is green. And to think of you is pleasantry to me." She's ignoring Solomon. She says in verse 17, "The beams of our house are cedar, our rafters are fir." That means that he was preparing the house See? And it's made out of rough-hewn timber, our house. This is a rough-hewn log cabin. You see the irony of that? See, the final settlement doesn't make any sense if you interpret it like it's normally interpreted. It don't give me this highfalutin, spiritual, high, strong interpretation of Song of Solomon. It does not make sense. People try to say it's the love story between spiritual, high, strong interpretation of Song of Solomon. It does not make sense. People try to say it's the love story between Solomon and a woman, and it illustrates Jesus Christ's love for the church. How could you say that when Solomon's trying to add another woman to the harem? He's got concubines in the book. He's got queens in the book. How can you interpret something like that and say God will put his approval on that when you know the rest of the Bible? It's impossible interpretation. This is not a unique interpretation. This is a traditional interpretation of the book. At least I traced it back to 1661. And that's the only way this book makes sense. This girl is thinking about her shepherd lover that she loves. And that same love is going to bring her through this trial. Solomon's stress situation is what we call tangible financial success and power success in the power structure politically and economically. That's his test. Maybe that's your test. Maybe you have lots of authority and power. Maybe you have lots of money. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not the evil. There's no evil in that. I've been rich and I've been poor. I'd rather be rich. No, 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 no. It's what your mental attitude is under those conditions. What you are that determines whether you will pass that test. This girl's test, as a believer, was the temptations to identify with that. You see? Solomon fails with all that we consider success, and she has absolutely nothing, and she succeeds in the book, spiritually. Fantastic book. Now, I'd like, during the book, to try to select some principles to share with you so that we have something objective here relative to the human love relationship. So I'm going to begin and try to give you five, and we'll close quickly. Okay? These are divine principles on human love, or relative to human love, based on the Song of Solomon and other verses. In other words, we're using this as a springboard to try to connotate some of these important principles of Scripture. Okay? Point one. God has established absolute living principles. Absolute living principles. Her relative to male-female relations in human love. These things would include such things as dating. They include such things as marriage. They would include such things as sex relations and so on. When we emphasize about the sexual relations, the sexual relations are only one aspect of human love. They're just one part of human love. Admittedly, they're an important part. But there's much more to the human relationship in love than just simply sex. Okay. Now, to break these principles, or not to abide, or not to discover these principles, and then to abide by them, damages the individual's capacity to appreciate and enjoy human love. It also damages, our capacity to receive love and to give love can be damaged by the breaking or the rupturing of those principles. So it's incumbent upon the believer to discover these principles that God has in His Word relative to the purposes of dating, marriage, and of sex, and so on. In other words, we could confront you under this point with this question: where do you get your information on the male-female relationship in what human beings call love? Where did you get your information? Or where do you get your information? There was a survey done in the 60s among teenagers as to where they got their information about marriage and sex and sexual relations, those two things. 22, this was done in the mid-60s. 22% of the replies said, among these teenagers, we learned about sex and dating and marriage from other children. This survey was done in kids from 12 through 16. They said from other children. 25% said, we learn our information about sex and dating and marriage and as relationships, we learned it from our peer group. Now that means you take out of children, 12 through 16, to the peer group. The 12-year-olds would be learning it from the 12-year-olds. The 15-year-olds would be learning it from the 15-year-olds. Okay? 33 to 45% that said, now where are they now? They said, we learned it from our friends within the peer group structure. So you learn it then. One says we learned it just from other children. Other one says we learned it from our peer group. Other one says we just learned it from our friends within the peer group. 3% said, we learned about sex and dating from the church. 3%. How tragic. Now, let's say you're 12, let's say you're 13, 14, 15, some of you 16, 17, the rest of you, you look like you're about 25. Now, 15-year-olds, okay? 15-year-olds? Now look, how much experience do your friends have in... Don't answer this. I'm not going to refer to sex. I'm talking about more, the more human love relationship. How much do your 15-year-old friends know about that? How could they know? How could they know what marriage is and what it means? The fact of the matter is they don't know. The fact of the matter is that what these 33 to 45% learned were the ignorance of the other kids, and they shared their ignorance on sex and dating and the marital relationship. And I want to tell you, it wasn't even much different when I was... I remember when I was 9 years old, and I can tell you the name of the guy who was telling me about... He had no arrow sitting on the wall by Dowdy's house with our moccasins on. We were city kids. We bought moccasins, and we'd buy a knife and put it in our belt. We're sitting there, and I was 9 years old. And I could tell you the name of the guy and start telling me about sex. I didn't know anything about that. I said, boy, that really sounds good. I was nine. That's what I learned. What I learned about sex and so on, I learned in the pool hall. Which meant that when I came to marriage, I brought all those hang-ups with me. standard question I ask a young couple when I'm dealing with them about marriage. I ask the girl, I say, what do you have to contribute to this marriage that's going to make it a success? What do you bring to the marriage? How knowledgeable are you in these areas, in this area, this area, this area? Say the same thing to the men. Usually what we bring to marriage is all our hang-ups, all the wrong information that we've learned. And one of the classic areas that we're usually ignorant in is in this area, because we have the wrong information. The place to learn about dating and marital relations and human love relations is the Bible. Where the divine viewpoint, where the person who invented all of this lays down the ground rules. And the person who abides by the ground rules will enjoy dating, marriage, and sex maximally. You'll have the capacity to do it. You people that are, you mothers and fathers that have teenagers, do you know what the primary concern of teenagers is in this area? Do you know what the chief concern is? They are concerned as to whether they're normal. They are worried about whether, as they pass through puberty, from the time they're 10 and 11, from the time the girl begins to develop and her breasts begin to develop, and a young man begins to pass through this difficult stage of leaving boyhood and becoming a man, one of the greatest things that they're concerned is whether they're normal. Do you know where they learn the definition of normality? From a peer group. Normal comes to be what is accepted among the peer group. One of the greatest pressures for a teenager to have sexual relations before marriage is his peer group. Now, whenever one of these interviews is on TV relative to the subject, I really listen to that. I look for those. I've listened to some of these authority figures. I listened to some of these teenagers express their view. Very interesting. Here's one teenager from New York saying, every time I come to school on Monday morning, the first thing I'm approached with is, did I make out over the weekend? Says, there's extreme pressure on us today as teenagers to have sexual relationships, whether we want to have it or not. We're not considered normal unless we have it. And I was sitting there watching, and I said, hey, kid, that's no different than when I was 16 in the inner city in Pittsburgh. Why do you think it's any different? You think people didn't have hormones in the past? Which are different nowadays? The difference nowadays is that if you took a poll today and asked the kids where they learned about sex, they would have to say the movies, the literature, and the pornographic material that's available, which is all sick. So in other words, they learned something about it, but they learned more ignorance about it. They did not learn divine viewpoint. They learned human viewpoint about it. And this thing is reinforced and reinforced and always has been ever since Adam fell. Sure, the teenagers put pressure on each other. And granted, it is one of their chief concerns, whether they're normal or not. They're worried if they're developing normally. They're concerned about what homosexuality is. They're concerned about their relationship to a male. Can I have a healthy relationship with a man? A young girl is concerned about that. A young man's concerned, can he have a healthy relationship with a girl with all this exposure to sex? They're bombarded with it on the televisions and the various media and the advertising media and so on. Now, where do you get your information? Where do you get what you believe about sex and about dating and about marriage and so on? Where do you get that information? That's something you teenagers ought to ask yourselves. Is it accurate information? Now, this girl in this book is a heroine. She is strong. She is strong because she has identified with God's plan in this matter. And when she met her right man, who was the shepherd, a beautiful, gorgeous relationship begins to unfold. And if you're a teenager, you can anticipate that too in God's plan for you. And that anticipation, and I beg you to learn all you can objectively about sex. I went to the, it was discovered in a law that they, kind of in a, sort of a sneaky law, they discovered over there they're going to have sex education in schools, and they have a film strip, and so on. A film strip, they have a multi-film strip sex education from sixth grade through high school. And they're instituting it in schools, and they haven't let the public know about it. Well, you know, that's an explosive issue. So, word got around that they were going to show some of the film strips at 9:30 on Tuesday morning. Well, who can go at 9:30 on Tuesday morning? Except guys that have a racket like me. So I don't know, and I want to tell you something. There were so many people showed up for that that they didn't have room to show it in. They had to open up another room and show it over there, and I asked the administrator, I said, does this tell you anything about the interest of the public in this? Why hasn't this been publicized? Why isn't there a public viewing of this? These parents are interested in what their children are going to learn about sex. And who's going to teach them? And who is going to interpret it? I don't care who teaches my child the facts of sex in a formal way, so they stick to the facts. But when they start saying what it means, then I care. And I have to be very honest about the first film strip that I saw. I thought it was excellent, absolutely excellent. Very objective, very factual. But the other ones that I saw, they just weren't too good. It's too much human viewpoint. And I don't want the public school to become a pulpit for human viewpoint on sex for my children. They get enough of that anywhere else. Why not it reinforced in the public school? If you're a teenager and you're concerned about this, don't you think that God isn't concerned about it? Don't think He hasn't made provision for you? Well, you can have some strength in this matter, and you will be a man and a woman, if you follow the divine viewpoint, that you will enjoy sex to the maximal. Why the young person who is parading himself before you like Solomon? His soul is destroyed. I'll show it to you, and I'm going to quit. Point two. Really don't have this. Well, I'm going to put point two, maybe three down. The capacity to love and receive love. Revolves around the soul. Hence the Shulah woman will say, O thou whom my soul loves. The Shulah woman will be protected by this. The Shulamite woman finds security. Let's put it that way. She finds security in soul love for her shepherd, her simple shepherd. And she is in the midst of opulence. Chapter 1, verse 5. Promiscuity. Destroys one's capacity to receive and give love. Rather than enhancing it. Human viewpoint says it enhances it. Human viewpoint says, why should I marry a guy who hasn't had any experience in sex? That's human viewpoint. You should marry a guy who hasn't been loose in sex, and a guy should marry a girl who hasn't been loose in sex because they're on sex together. You want it mutually, and you enjoy it. And your other experiences that you think are learning experiences, they are only learning experiences in a negative way. They are destructive to you in your capacity to love. So promiscuity, rather than, as Hugh Hefner says it will enhance love, it does not. It destroys it, the capacity to give love, rather than enhancing it. Now, I'm going to show you that in the Bible. If you think the Bible isn't up to date, you just listen to this passage. Turn to Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 32. I'm going to have to deal with this subject, so I won't say a whole lot about it tonight, because this is a very important subject. We have to deal with it in some detail, because it's part of the ongoing of human relationships. Since true love is soul love first, and soul love has the capacity then of enlarging, so on. And soul love can be destroyed, the capacity, but we'll have to deal more with. Look at verse 32 of Proverbs. Whoso committeth adultery with a woman lacketh understanding. He that doeth it in a continual passage, in a continuum sort of way, destroys his own soul. The man out that was Solomon. Okay? He is involved in darkness and hardening of the soul, so that he will destroy his capacity to love. And next Sunday night, we'll take up right there with that concept, the third concept, and we'll show you how that happens and how that doctrine is delineated in Ephesians chapter 4. Now, let me just give an illustration of that. And I do this with no vindictiveness or any malice toward anybody. I do it out of sympathy. This is illustrated to this point, and this concept is illustrated again and again to us. One of the best illustrations of it that I can think of is Marilyn Monroe, and I say that with no hostility toward her. I feel sorry for that woman. That woman was so abused and so used by men that she had no capacity in her anymore to express love. She was a tool in these books that talk about her capacity to act, and so ridiculous, absolutely ludicrous. She had a beautiful body, and the publicity agents and the Hollywood people found out of it, discovered it, and they exploited it. She was absolutely exploited until she lost all sense of self-dignity and identity in life, and she committed suicide. And she is not the only one who has done that. What do young people see of Hollywood? They see the glamour side. But anybody who's been there will tell you it's a horrible place. If they could strike it from their human experience, they would. People are abused and bought and purchased and sold until their souls are destroyed. It's happening, and they end up committing suicide. When we think, when people who have very little, and they look at that as the glamorous way of life, they think it's so great, and those people in that way of life are committing suicide, or they're in the mental hospital, or they're paying a psychiatrist to try to put it together for them. Why? Because they are so involved in adulterous human relationships that they call love that their soul is totally, absolutely destroyed, and they don't care to live anymore. How then does promiscuity, how can that enhance? How does sexual looseness enhance your capacity to love? Impossible. It'll never happen. It's one of the principles that God has designed. Next Sunday we'll take up there, and we'll talk about the problem of darkness in the soul. We'll show how Solomon confesses to the fact that this has happened to him. Shall we pray? Thank you, our Father, for this time. We thank you for the good number of families that are here, many that have teenagers. We pray that these things will become meaningful to mothers and fathers and important to them, and to these many fine teenagers that we have here. May God the Holy Spirit impress upon them from this beautiful love story. two things, both the joy and the fulfillment that the human love relationship can bring, and also the importance of keeping that within your prescribed limits, your directives. In Jesus' name we pray.